really great. Not an empty chair, some on the floor. And thank you so much, Brian and Elaine and anyone else who worked towards getting this going. It's a great thing. I'm just going to go over some of the things I encountered in translating some of Les Fleurs du Mal, some generalities and probably some truisms and some details, and then I'll read a few of the translations. I began translating Baudelaire almost on a whim, since I was going to Paris for a six-month residency. I flicked open Les Fleurs du Mal and settled on Les Plaintes de Nicard. It was pretty short. Thought it would be easy. I made the mistake, if you like, of deciding to produce a metrical rhymed version, and the fascination of what is difficult pushed me to try more. The first ones were the hardest and went through many drafts. It was like doing Rubik's Cube in three dimensions, upside down in a swimming pool, maybe. Often the main problems were metrical, even more than getting the rhyme, I think. Getting the detail of Baudelaire's Alexandrines into iambic pentameters, because I thought they sounded more natural in English, easier to do. There is no end to the tinkering that can be done. And there's always the salutary anxiety about error. The word or phrase misunderstood, the lapse of tone, the lost implication, and the concern over what has had to be knowingly left out. I aimed for a sort of loose fidelity, a general deference to the source text, while aspiring to the musicality of Baudelaire's poetry as far as I could, which did often mean a departure from the literal. Valéry defines the poem as cette hésitation prolongée entre le son et le son. With Baudelaire's poetry in particular, the sound pattern is not merely a surface effect, so much as a deeper pre-verbal layer of meaning, setting up correspondences and reflecting his perception of the universe, une ténébreuse et profonde unité, a deep, dark unity. My goal was to achieve a convincing poem in English, if I could, with occasional gain as well as inevitable loss. A pessimistic view of translation does emphasize what is lost, but the greatest leap of translation, I think, is from the writer's initial perception into the first language. And how much of that elusive, nuanced experience can be carried into language? Well, I'm an optimist. I see literary translation as a sort of recreation while keeping a difficult balance. Perhaps in the circus of literature, the translator is the tightrope walker, with juggling as a side skill. Part of the balance is the attempt to re-experience, I think, the pre-linguistic moment of the source text, to follow the thought processes of the originator, the author, to be receptive to its effect, and then to bring about a similar state of mind in readers of the target language. Lots of room for slipping up in between those steps, I know. Some strategic decisions came about as reasonable compromises, I thought, following trial and error. I've heard it said that only four rhymes are satisfactory in formal rhyming translations of Les Fleurs du Mal. But since English is not rich in rhyme, I decided that half rhymes would suffice when necessary, especially when close in sound and effect to the French words. I avoided generalization from specified items to their class when I could. Syntax and punctuation necessarily changed. I cut back on the exclamation marks, for instance. Texture, vowel color, and consonant weight could be approximated often. With capitalized abstractions such as beauty, death, suffering, and memory, I sometimes drop the capital, though this can't very well be done in a poem such as Recueillement, with its very strong personification, give me your hand, my sadness. This occasional sidestepping of allegory, so important to Baudelaire, is certainly open to criticism, I know. With titles and first lines, important signal points of a poem, I gave faithfulness a particularly high priority, literal faithfulness. easier about bypassing a straight and obvious translation when the French words might have been chosen by Baudelaire, partly for their rhyme, and when I could pick up a shade of meaning from a similar poem in the collection. I bore in mind Baudelaire's vocabulary, his characteristic, even favourite words, his use of ambivalence and synesthesia, and his sensitivity to sounds and scents, perfumes, and to the exotic. Alliteration came when it would. If internal rhyme could not be summoned at the same point as in the French text, then it sometimes arrived as a bonus elsewhere, in the same poem or in a different poem. I'm by no means a scholarly translator. I sort of plunged in and then did research when necessary as I went along. Sometimes to my horror, I had to rewrite bits and lost easy rhymes. So I found myself checking on details about Paris, the social history of the time, and also following up classical references such as Cybele, Megara, Pyrrhus and Helenus, Pylades, the river Pactolus, and so on. Critical articles on Baudelaire, including critiques of individual poems, helped me to correct some misreadings and outright errors, especially where I jumped to a conclusion or had confused two words. Aimant and amant, for example. I think that I had, in a cat poem, my eyes are drawn to you as to a lover. That seemed very logical, but of course it's my eyes are drawn to you as to a magnet. Aimant. I also mixed up vril and grille. I thought I was very clever knowing that word, but so my first draft of Les Petites Vieilles described one of Baudelaire's little old women as having eyes like a cricket instead of a gimlet. On checking a critique, I realised my version of spleen, quand le ciel bat l'eau, had a howling error, quite literally. I had found a false friend in the word hurlement and made it hurling, which fitted the context beautifully, I thought. The correct translation is, of course, howling, which in true Baudelairean style challenged its context. I looked at other translations only when I'd finished my own fairly viable drafts. It's far too easy to remember another translator's phrase as your own. And then also, if there were significant differences, I really scrutinised my version closely and checked absolutely everything, even the articles in the dictionary. I emailed several ambiguous lines to French friends for clarification. Stanza 3 of Messenia, for example, in The Swan. Baudelaire remembers the old carousel and uses the phrase brillant au carreau, le bric-à-brac confus, which to me seemed possibly to mean the jumbled bric-à-brac shining on the tiles, but I believe it is the jumbled bric-à-brac glittering at the panes. The relationship of the translator to the writer and his or her text is complex, intimate, admiring, ambivalent, exasperated, celebratory. And although you have more freedom when the author is dead, you have far less assistance. No argument, though. Can you imagine translating Baudelaire in his lifetime? Oh. I do agree with Charles Simic, who reckons translation is an actor's medium. You take on the role of your author, and the process becomes a sort of dialogue. You might end up schizoid, of course. When I was hesitating over alternatives, trying to vary verbs and images, or negotiating changes between the singular and the plural of a noun, as in the albatross, I asked myself how Baudelaire himself might have dealt with the problem in English. Translation has been called a lonely task, but I found it can seem quite a companionable process, especially when the writer has a stronger presence and voice as Charles Baudelaire. I realised after a while that with some poems I had been, where I'd been quite literal, the result was stodgy or stilted. I had to loosen up and sacrifice some detail to avoid a crammed effect or rhythmical clumsiness and unlikely rhymes. For example, in Dawn, the first draft of one line, debauchees were returning, broken by their labours, eventually became worn-out womanizers hit the home path. in there. I think you've got to have a little bit of Aussie slang to get its way in. Conversely, though, in the poem which begins, Tu mettrais l'univers dans ta ruelle, an early draft was over exuberant and unnecessarily off track, so I had to tone it down. The first version had been, dead boredom's turned you cruel. Do you keep tally, you slut? You'd shove the whole race up your alley. At least it was a feminine rhyme, but it did end up... It ended up, more accurately, as you'd have the universe vie for your bed, you slut. You're turning cruel because you're bored. The visibility of the translator is, of course, an issue. I personally needed to guard against a tendency to strain for resolution, to grasp at a mediocre rhyme, to soften or minimise the horrific, this was pointed out to me, I was, or alternatively, to exaggerate some lurid details to fill out a line. But it did seem reasonable, when unavoidable, to extend certain phrases or images by a sort of innocuous padding, in the spirit of the original, I hoped, so as to achieve a rhyme, a correct emphasis, or the right tone or pace. In L'Albatros, the Albatross, one line describes the poet as laughing at the archer. In my translation, the poet is laughing at arrows and slings. With the giantess, in which the poet imagines he is a cat, I changed the landscape a little. A fairly close non-rhyming translation for the last lines might be, and sometimes in summer, when the unhealthy suns stretched her listless across the countryside, I would sleep nonchalantly in the shadow of her breasts, like a peaceful hamlet at the foot of a mountain. Well, for the rhyme, I needed to do this. And when the sultry heat of summer splayed her drowsily out across an acre of grass, I'd fall asleep below her breasts in the shade, like a village nestled up to a mountain pass. I like the fact that I got the cleavage in there. The degrees of formality and informality, the use of vous and tu, for example, created in some poems a shifting or ambivalent mood. That's in the originals, I mean, obviously. This was difficult to echo since the intimate tone of toi or tu is not directly transposable now as it was in Victorian times. Half of the last line of à une passante, to a woman passing by, translates literally as, O thou whom I could have loved, using the familiar toi towards the woman, and also the literary form of the past conditional in toi que j'eusse aimé, giving, I think, a formal but delicate tone, a melancholy distance. At the same time, the necessary agreement of the past participle aimé, loved, with the object of desire, the woman passing by, strengthens the intimate linguistic link between her and the narrator. There is a movement towards and away which focuses on the moment of passing. The English you and our all-purpose past conditional lose those shifting subtleties of feeling. Compare the French and the English of the final two lines. Car j'ignore où tu fuis, tu ne sais où je vais. Ô toi que j'eusse aimé, ô toi qui le savais. Where the other is going, neither of us can tell. Yet I could have loved you, and you knew it well. It really is fairly different, isn't it? I think the tone, but it's a free translation in more everyday speech, which is what I needed, but alas, without those nuances. Shklovsky's notion of ostranenie, defamiliarization, is particularly relevant, I think, to Baudelaire's work. Shklovsky believed that perception should be prolonged and that art presents things as they are perceived, not as they are known. So I was wary of smoothing out or rationalizing what seemed odd done into English, if it sounded strange in French as well. And that was sometimes hard for me to work out. I checked with some French friends. As Baudelaire wrote, the beautiful is always bizarre. The perception of the beautiful and the true does vary from one culture to another. Translation involves, I think, the representation or suggestion of these and other values, thus of one particular worldview in terms of another. The intrinsic differences between two languages reflect these perceptual differences. We do think differently in different languages. Yves Bonnefoy points out a basic distinction between English and French. English is Aristotelian, concrete, and values the thing, while French is Platonic and tends to abstraction, reduces and maps the idea and values the symbol. As Lawrence Sterne has his Sentimental Traveller say, the grandeur of the French sublime is more in the word and less in the thing. I have translated some ideas in terms of things, but I've also moved in the French direction, from a concrete to an abstract noun. In L'harmonie du soir, evening harmony, I despaired of a rhyme for the final word monstrance, which sounds unsympathetic to me in English anyway. I named instead the religious celebration itself. So the last stanza reads, a tender heart that dreads the black abyss guards every scrap the shining past will spare. The sun in thick blood light is drowning there. Your memory glows in me like the Eucharist. Can poetry transcend the innate tendencies of a given language, as Miroslav Holub, for one, believed? Rhythm, timing, the quality of a silence, line endings and connotations are so elusive. Word connotation is very hard to duplicate, and it's dispiriting to lose the sometimes ironic effect of homonyms. The French word vers, meaning both lines and worms, as well as towards, suits Baudelaire's bent very well in these lines from Spleen, J'ai plus de souvenirs. Où comme des remords se traînent de longs vers, qui s'acharnent toujours sur mes morts les plus chers. I had to be explicit rather than subtle and overstate the eating away connotation of remorse. These lines, long desperate worms trailing remorse, devour my dearest dead to eat up loss. You can trip over unwanted associations. I was interested to hear Justin's ideas that you should not try and translate proper names. I totally agree. Agathe in Moesta et Erebunda is not really the French sister of Agatha. Another example of a word with different connotations in English and French is armoire. A-R-M-O-I-R-E, I don't trust my pronunciation, when translated as wardrobe or cupboard. Although the straight translation, a wardrobe in an empty house, is fine for the sinister poem Le Flacon, the compliment offered to the young woman in La Belle Navire, the beautiful ship, does seem a bit cumbersome. That proud bosom's like a fine wardrobe. A wardrobe full of good things and secret joys. Other translators have also balked at that wardrobe. It's great fun looking at, you know, 8 or 10 different versions of a difficult line. Some have chosen coffer or simply kept armoire with its apt echo of à moi or mine. Carrying over one everyday word may be more awkward than furniture removal. I finally settled on cabinet, since it extended well as a metaphor. There were divergences, omissions and additions as I wrestled with syntax and word order, as well as diction. I rendered the famous last line of Au lecteur to the reader, not as hypocritical reader, my counterpart, my brother, but as hypocrite reader, my counterpart, my twin. Again for the rhyme. This need to find chiming words, though, can make for ingenuity and sort of serendipity. And I thought I'd just give you a few examples of divergences, not necessarily my best bits. These are places where I feel I had to depart a bit, and I hope it's justified. The first stanza of Correspondence, translates fairly literally as, nature is a temple where living pillars sometimes allow confused words through. Man passes across forests of symbols which observe him with familiar looks. I sort of regularize this by a variation and doubling up of the nouns. Of the nouns, words, pillars, and forests. So it reads, and I'm not at all happy with this, it's been through about 25 drafts. In nature's temple, eerie words and cries rise from her living pillars and arcades. A thousand symbols breathe in woods and glades and watch us pass with long familiar eyes. In the final lines of Le Gouffre, the abyss, I reverse subject and object. The line is, ah, ne jamais sortir des nombres et des êtres. Ah, never to get away from numbers and beings. Seems a bit ambivalent, even ambiguous, even though I struggled with Pascal. So my version picks up that uncertainty from a different angle. Will forms and numbers never let me be? In La Musique, turning the noun mirror to a verb and adding the filler word, filler words are very useful, adding the filler word there gave the emphasis needed in the final image of the sea. D'autrefois, calme miroir de mon désespoir became, till dead calm mirrors there my own despair. In the balcon, the balcony, stanza three, I believe I kept close to the tone while very freely juggling with the words and phrases. Literally it would be, how soft your breast was to me, how good your heart. Often we said imperishable things, those evenings lit up by the glow of charcoal. My version was, or is the full stanza, those evenings lit by the glowing charcoal fire, or veiled in rosy mist, as you and I talked on the balcony, all my desire, dear heart, soft breast, was that our words not die, those evenings lit by the glowing charcoal fire. I move towards the tangible in Bohemien en route, Gypsies on the Move. The literal translation would be, of the last line would be, the familiar empire of future shadows. I made it, whose empire is tomorrow's dark terrain. My choice of poems was eclectic, even haphazard at first, but once about 20 poems were done, I began to think it might make a manuscript, so I looked to get a balance of subject, tone, and length in the further choices I made. As I've worked on these translations, I've come to appreciate aspects of Baudelaire's character and work that seem to receive rather less critical attention. The empathy and sensitivity and tenderness, say, to be found in some of the love poems, and in passages of Les Petites Filles, The Little Old Women. I'll finish by reading four of the translations, and Bridget, you can do your wiggle act. And they'll be up here behind me, so you can see where I slipped up by looking at the French. Her gown is the first one. Her undulating gown's like mother of pearl, so even when she walks, you'd think she danced. The way long temple cobras will uncoil and sway before their keeper's wands entranced. Like endless desert sands and Asia skies, both insensible to human pain, like the long swelling network of the seas, she sweeps her skirts along in cool disdain. Her eyes are finest minerals burnished bright. Her nature, rife with symbols, strangely links angel inviolate and time-worn sphinx. And through that gold and steel and diamond light glitters the sterile woman's majesty, a cold white star contracting endlessly. One of the spleen poems, I think this must be the dreariest poem he wrote, Spleen, the brooding sky. When the brooding sky, like a heavy lowered lid, weighs on the trembling spirit racked by doubt, and in at the far horizon rim is poured a day that's darker than the saddest night. When earth is changed to a narrow, fetid jail, where hope like a frantic bat, twitching and reeling, scrapes her timid wings on every wall, and knocks her head against the rotted ceiling. When threadbare rain trails its tattered cloak to mark with bars the limits of our cell, and a mute, monstrous tribe of spider folk spin out their little death traps in the skull. Then all the bells leap up in sudden blame to hurl their frightful howling at the air. The way that wandering souls without a home keep whining on and on in grey despair. And verse after verse, with neither dirge nor drum, files slowly through my being. Hope has fled, and the dreadful despot anguish stakes his claim, drives his black flag into my drooping head. And une charogne, carcass. This is the first poem I ever read of Baudelaire's. I was 18 and I thought it was wonderful. I think you can see why. The last line wonderfully redeems it. Do you remember what we saw, my soul, that bright summer's day? Right in our path, a dreadful carcass sprawled on its bed of pebbles and clay. With the legs thrust up like a woman gripped by lust, the seething poisonous mass coolly and cynically offered us as we passed its belly a stinking gas. Onto this rotting flesh the sun's rays poured, cooking it to a turn, rendering to nature a hundredfold what she had labored to join. The sky was gazing down on this proud carcass, opening like a flower. So shocking was the stench, you sank on the grass, overcome by its power. Flies were buzzing over the putrid hide, and black larvae squads were pouring out like streams of viscous liquid, animating the shreds. The body lifting and falling like a wave, bubbling, spattering, sighing, seemed to be vaguely drawing breath alive, thriving and multiplying. An eerie music was rising from that world like flowing water or wind, or the grain in a winnower's sieve rhythmically swirled, then tossed up high and turned. The shapes were effacing themselves as in a dream, a sketch slow to come right, on a canvas now long lost, with the artist's scheme traced only in hindsight. Lurking behind some rocks, a restless fish sent us an evil look, greedy for the moment she could snatch her ripped-off morsel back. And yet, you too will be like this, a foul, stinking abomination. You, star of my eyes, son of my soul, my angel and my passion. Yes, you will come to this, O Queen of Graces. The last sacraments done, you will be lowered under the flowers and grasses to moulder among bones. Then, my beautiful one, say to the worm with its kissing, nibbling lust, that I hold safe the divine essence and form of my love decayed to dust. I don't want to finish on that note, but I've got time to read one more. Invitation to the Voyage. Okay. This is the hardest, everybody agrees on this, the hardest one of his to translate, and I've not seen a really successful translation. I think Robert Bly has done one in iambic pentameter, and that is beautiful. Oh, I did my best. How sweet it would be, sister child, you and me setting off for the lowlands together, to love as we please, love and die at our ease, where you're kin to the everyday weather. The sun's humid rays, those hazy grey skies, have a charm and a mystery like yours, the cunning disguise of your traitorous eyes sparkling at me through their tears. There all is harmony and peace, richness, beauty, sensuous bliss. Fine tables and chairs, soft glossed by the years, would furnish our lofty room. Rare blooms, never spent, would mingle their scent with grey amber's subtle perfume. The deep mirrored scenes on ceilings and screens, the splendours of all the Far East, would whisper their spell to the listening soul in the soft tongue she spoke first. There all is harmony and peace, richness, beauty, sensuous bliss. See those mast tips, the canal's quiet ships dreaming their vagabond ways. To assuage the fire of your least desire, they'll sail the seven seas. And each setting sun will redress the town, the fields, the canals, and the port in hyacinth and gold, as the turning world falls asleep in that warm light, where all is harmony and peace, luxury, beauty, sensuous bliss. Thank you.